Okay, welcome to this last lecture on week four of the banking course. There's even smaller crowd of people here than yesterday, and one of the reasons might be that this is the rally weekend in US, but nevertheless, these things keep on going without any reference to the results from the rally. I actually downloaded now also the instructions for the home assignment one. Just half an hour ago. So you can take a look at that and you can start doing the home assignment one at least immediately or already during the weekend. And then I will be downloading the instructions and the article material for home assignment two at the beginning of next week, either on Monday or Tuesday. I have been waiting for the final results from some of the papers that I will be including. There's going to be a team about central bank digital currencies also there. And that is in that case, because it's belonging to the themes of the home assignment too, it will be more related to the monetary policy point of view. But nevertheless, that's the thing that will be coming. We just had a report, very short summary from Bank for International Settlements, that has launched a project regarding central bank digital currencies. I got that report yesterday. So that will be included as a short summary about the description of the current stage of that development. So I will be downloading those instructions also next week. So you can start doing also the second home assignment almost immediately, even though we have not finished all the themes here. And next week, I would very much like to see much more people here in the classroom because Jari Mikko is coming to give the lectures next week about regulation. And he has organized his things in a way that he would be able to come here. So please come and follow his lectures. Okay, we are now here discussing about the role of budget deficits or the general government budget in terms of how is it related to the monetary policy actions. And obviously, most of you already have been introduced to this idea of public sector or fiscal policies, so you know the main ideas. The main idea for you to understand here with respect to the effects of the monetary policy is that nowadays we are actually in a situation where I have been already mentioning this several times, that we are in a situation where it's really difficult to make a distinction between these two. Because in a standard model or the standard world, you should be able to separate fiscal policies from monetary policies. And the main idea there is that in terms of the fiscal policy actions, there are two ways that the government can pay for spending. It can either raise revenue, which means that it's increasing some forms of taxation, for example, indirect taxation that's related to the income taxation, or direct taxation that's related to the paying value-added taxes when you buy something, basically. Those are the broad categories for this. Or if it's not able to do that, it can borrow. And nowadays, the governments have been borrowing really heavily. At the euro area level, current debt ratios of the government public sector or the public debt ratios are around 100% with respect to the GDP. So they usually have, on average terms, they have as much debt as they have production within a year. And that is a big amount. In Finland, we have at the moment 70% debt ratio, and some of the economists and some of the civil servants or public sector servants are worried about that. The opposition in the parliament of Finland is really worried about that. It's a kind of a sexy thing to be worried about that because it gives you some kind of weapons to have some kind of political discussions. But it has been a necessary thing for most of the governments also in Europe to do these things because we have had this corona crisis. But there is a possibility in general terms, actually, that the government can also create money because it has basically the central bank there. They are governmental institutions. Even though the ECB, for example, is an intergovernmental institution, it's formed of various countries, central banks of various countries. So basically, if you have a deficit in the public budget, which means that you have more expenses than you have revenues, and you are running a deficit, then it's obviously the first thing that you as a public servant can do, a policymaker can do, is to borrow more. The second thing is to increase the monetary base by the central bank. So the politicians sort of instruct the central bank to print more money. Nowadays, we are living a bit difficult situation in terms of this, because these are now sort of a mixed. All of the government bonds or the debt is not being held by the general public, households and firms and the banking sector. Most of that actually is nowadays being held by the central banks. And that is not a good thing, actually, because that introduces the problem to this general idea about funding the deficits. How do you fund? How do you get the funding for running deficits at the governmental level? For example, in Finland, we currently have in the budget that is being discussed at the parliament at the moment, we have a deficit of 2.5%. That's not a big. We are actually meeting these convergence criteria of the euro area, that is minus 3% or 3% deficit. We are still meeting that. We are not meeting the debt ratio requirement, that is 60%. We are exceeding that at the moment, but not nearly as much as the other euro area countries. So we have kind of a problem, but not too serious. I hope that some of you were able to follow yesterday's A-plus show or program in TV, where Sixten Korkman and Mikko Spolander from the State Treasury were discussing about these things in Finnish. So you don't understand both probably that, but they raised these issues actually that we have been already discussing here. That it's not a huge problem, especially Sixten Korkman was not too worried about that, because he can sleep well overnight, according to his saying that if our debt ratio is not approaching the European average. So basically, we have really good possibilities to get more funding from the markets, even without involvement of the central bank. That was the thing that Sixten actually didn't mention there. But nevertheless, because ECB is instructing also the Bank of Finland to take part to the government debt markets, so we are still buying the government debt. So this idea of separating possibilities to get more funding for the government sector through the extension of the monetary base by printing money gets now to be mixed with the taking more new loan by the government sector. It's not a good thing. Because they are, you cannot basically make a distinction between these two now. They are intertwined quite a lot. So the dynamic government budget constraint is still really an important thing, because it should give you an idea about the level of government deficit, how it is financed. Is it financed by an increase in bond holdings by the public? The main idea here is originally that all the government debt is being held by, as an asset, by the general public, not the banks so much perhaps, and at least not by the central banks. But it's not the case anymore. During the latest 5 years, the extension of the central bank's balance sheets in terms of their asset development has been based on buying more and more government bonds and also corporate bonds. So this is a difficult situation basically now. So it should be, original idea has been that it should be possible to separate the actions that are being made through changes in the monetary base, that is the extension of the money supply by increasing the monetary base, from the changes in the public debt. So it's not basically at the moment, it's not the case. You are not able to do that distinctions. Luckily enough, we are not in the situation of hyperinflation at the moment. Inflation rates have been really low, so we do not have to fight against inflation too heavily. And basically these huge extensions of the monetary base, huge sort of injections of more liquidity to the banking system have not induced inflation. That's not the case for some of the emerging countries, for example. In Latin America, for example, there are really big problems there because the inflation rate is really high there. So sort of a possibility to do too much expansionary monetary policy actions are really, really limited there. So, but in historical terms, many economies have experienced these hyperinflation periods. But for example, United States have not experienced more than 10 or 15% inflation rates at the annual level. So it's not really actually very high in historical terms. When we have countries like Argentina, where you have annual inflation rate of hundreds of percents, it's really, and in Russia, in some periods also, we have had these situations that the annual inflation rate is more than 100%. So prices double every year, at least double. So that's not a good thing. So there are some examples, especially in the set of developing countries where there are these periods of hyperinflation. Then from the theoretical point of view, we have been discussing about this very, very simple quantity theoretic model of money supply. And John Maynard Keynes already at the end of 1930s introduced the next version of this thing. So that sort of gives the standard classification of economists to be divided into Keynesian school and the classical school. Classical school more or less says that everything should be dictated by the markets. And if you increase money supply, it only has a short-term nominal effect on inflation. It doesn't have an effect on the real economic development. The main thing that affects real economic development is the productivity of the inputs, either capital or labor. But in Keynesian theory, there is a role for also the monetary policy. So monetary policy is sort of idealized to have an effect also on the real economic development. So you can divide in Keynesian analysis, you can divide clearly, should be able to divide the policy actions to fiscal policy actions and monetary policy actions. And this now is a problematic thing because it's not working at the moment. So when we talk about money demand, we are then talking about the part of the monetary policy effects. We assume that you have some kind of equilibrium there in the money markets. Still, the central bank is the one that supplies the money, the amount of money, and the general public is the one that demands the money. Originally for their purchasing purposes. They want to consume, they want to invest, and they want to use the money for real economic actions. That's the key thing. So in this case, we are talking about the so-called Keynesian liquidity preference theory. What is the main idea? Previously, we assumed that the interest rate doesn't have any role in the demand for money. Money demand is only related to the development of income. Now we are introducing the possibility that interest rate also has an effect as an opportunity cost for holding more money. If the interest rate increases, the opportunity cost in the form of lost interest income increases if you are holding more money. So you should figure this out in terms of this or think this in terms of this opportunity cost. So in Keynesian theory, we have three motives for holding money. Some of you might already be familiar with this, but some of you might not. We have this transactions motive. That's the original principal motive of holding money in any form. also in electronic form. So the demand is proportional to income, but payment technologies have also an effect there. But nevertheless, the motivation comes for the need to do real economic transactions, buying things for consumptions and investments. Then there's this precautionary motive. So money is designed there or idealized to serve as a cushion for unexpected wants, and it's once again proportional to income. The more you have income, the more you have also buffers to react against unexpected changes in your preferences. Then the final thing is here, the speculative motive. So in this case, we think that money is ideally actually one form of wealth. Well, that's actually a bit questionable in some occasions, because obviously it sort of introduces the risk component also of your wealth with respect to the inflation, actually. So that's actually something that is you should consider also in this case. But nevertheless, you have to distinguish here between real and nominal quantities of money. Real quantities of money that take into account the effect of inflation or the price level at the moment. So you deflate the nominal quantity of money by the current price level. So you get the real purchasing power of your money holdings. And those are used for real purchasing purposes. So you are buying something for consumption needs and so on. Okay. So in terms of mathematical, very simple notations, we are now defining the money demand equation in terms of real cash balances. So at the left-hand side, we have the definition for the money demand in real terms. So we are talking about so-called real cash balances of individual agents. So the nominal money demand is divided by the current price level. That gives you the purchasing power of your holdings of money in terms of current level of prices. So obviously, the higher is the price level, the lower is your real purchasing power. Then this F denotes now to the general functional form. It can be a quadratic form, expanded. It can be an exponential form. It can be just a simple linear form. But nevertheless, the main arguments in Keynesian theory are there that there's a nominal interest rate that has an effect, and also the real income that has an effect. Basically, if you are considering really carefully this money demand equation, and also this interest rate should be actually real. So the real interest rate is the thing that gives you really an idea about the purchasing power of if you are willing to save now, what is the future increase in the purchasing power based on real interest rate. So that takes care also the role of inflation. But it's a bit difficult to understand here, because we are talking about levels of prices. So if you want to consider exactly the real interest rate, you should be discussing about changes in the level of prices, so inflation by definition. And it's not exactly the same thing. So basically, this is a bit loosely given representation for the main arguments for the determinants of money demand in the Keynesian model. But nevertheless, you can write this also in the form of quantity theoretic representation. So you can get the velocity thing here, or the velocity variable actually here, if you rewrite that equation so that just turn around everything. So you have the key price variable there at the denominator and money demand at the denominator, and then one over the function is the giving you the idea about the price level with respect to the money demand. When you multiply this by the real economic activity or income and replace the following the idea that the money markets are always in equilibrium. So you replace money demand with money supply. MD is replaced by M, assuming that you have a market equilibrium, then you can get the idea for the velocity, meaning of velocity in this model. So once again, velocity is exactly the same thing here than in the quantity theoretic model. It describes the sort of speed of circulation of money, one unit of money in the economy. So basically you have kind of a similar things there going on, but you have now introduced also the possibility that interest rate, in addition to income, also the interest rate does have an effect as an opportunity cost of holding more money. You lose the interest income if you want to hold more cash holdings of money. And interest rate is referring to here to all kinds of forms, return yielding assets. We can calculate the interest rate like amount of return for each and every asset that gets a price quotation from the markets. So when we have these three motives together in the same model, we are actually now assumed that velocity is not constant. And that is the critical thing here that sort of makes a difference between the standard quantity theoretical model and the Keynesian model. The pro-cyclical movement of interest rates should give actually pro-cyclical movement in velocity. Pro-cyclical means that you go to the same direction as the income goes in the variable. And velocity will change as expectations about future normal levels of interest rates change. So the main thing here is that velocity is also in connection to the interest rates. Actually, that should be normal. That should be nominal in the model, not normal. We are not talking about, well, we are basically talking about potential level of production here, but that should be actually nominal. And I have to correct that to the slides. There's a typo there. Then the next extension is actually because we already sort of started the discussion about the role of all forms of assets to which you can calculate kind of a interest-like return, rate of return. So the further extension actually refers to the portfolio theories, and they are actually based also on this Keynesian type of model. So we are now introducing the possibility of portfolio choice. Basically, the portfolio choice induces to the model the role of risk, the risk of changing valuation of the assets. And usually it's a historical risk that we are considering. Basically, like in a capital asset pricing model type analysis that Heikki is discussing in more details in his course, we are sort of introducing the second moment of the return distribution to the analysis of all the assets. So it can justify the conclusion from the Keynesian liquidity preference theory that the demand for real money balances is positively related to income and negatively related to the nominal interest rates. And other factors are being introduced based on this portfolio analytical approach. So the general level of wealth has a role to do there in determining the money demand. Risk of other assets, so the relative risk of investment to something else than the money. It's the second thing. And then liquidity of the other assets. The more easy it's to get involved into the market, so the more there is volume in transactions in other markets, obviously it will have an effect on the demand for that kind of assets. Once again, it's a relative demand and relative liquidity of the other assets. So you basically compare the number of volumes or the transactions in the markets that are relevant for you in terms of making a choice. So here are here's the summary table of the factors that have an effect on the demand for money in the Keynesian liquidity theoretical and portfolio theoretical synthesis of money demand analysis. So if there's a change in the interest rates, the money demand will go vice versa. If there's an increase in interest rate, the money demand will go down. So we are here always interested about how does the money demand react to these variables. If there's a positive change in the income, it will increase money demand. If payment in technologies improve, the demand for actual holdings of cash, which refers to the origins of the money demand, or the first component of the money demand, it will decrease. So electronic payment systems have really, we have really strong empirical evidence now that the development electronic payment services has decreased the amount of money in your wallets. That's a practical finding that we have. And increases in wealth are also positively related to the money demand. Riskiness of other assets. So you have to compare the riskiness of other assets compared to the riskiness of money demand or money. If there's an increase in the riskiness of other assets with respect to the riskiness of money, then money demand will increase. You are risk aversive in general terms. And the inflation risk also, because based on definition, the price level has a big role there. It reduces the purchasing, real purchasing power of your money holdings. Then if there's a risk increase in inflation, then it will decrease also the money demand. Liquidity of other assets relative to the money markets will also have an effect, and it will have a negative effect on the money demand because these are substitutes. The main idea in the Keynesian analysis is that money demand, or the holdings of money and holdings of any other forms of assets, are substitutes. They are not complementary, they are substitutes to each other. Okay, so we have now established that if interest rates do not affect the demand for money, velocity is more likely to be constant. That's the standard quantitative theoretic approach. But the more sensitive the demand for money is to interest rates, the more unpredictable is the velocity. And less clear is the link between the money supply and aggregate spending, because these interest rate things are getting involved. What kind of ideas does this raise to your mind now that we are experiencing negative interest rates? What is the implication of negative interest rates based on Keynesian liquidity theory of money demand? Is it an incentive or disincentive to hold more money? Yeah.
Because you can't get any profit from that.
Exactly. If you are considering only on the interest yielding asset markets, you are not considering the portfolio theoretical part of this extension. So you're not considering the stock markets at all. The negative interest rates are serving as a incentive to hold more money. And that is the fact that has actually appeared. People are really holding in electronic forms. You don't hold more money in plain cash, like coins and notes in your wallets, but in other forms. So you have huge holdings in your transaction deposits or transaction accounts at the moment. So this precautionary motive of the Keynesian approach actually is playing there some kind of role, probably. And it's sort of overriding the interest rate effect actually also at the moment. So there is some kind of uncertainty still for the representative consumer, like you want to use in the economics models, to hold excess amounts of liquidity in forms of the most appropriate forms of that, because the income uncertainty is still there. The future doesn't seem so certain, even though the confidence indexes of the consumers have been increasing quite a lot, because it seems to be the case that we are surviving very well, actually, from this corona crisis. But nevertheless, this is a really interesting thing. You can actually explain part of the increases in the liquidity of the general public or the transaction accounts of general public based on this Keynesian liquidity preference theory. Because the interest rate, nominal interest rate, is now negative in Europe and zero in the US, but the real interest rates are even lower. They are really, really low at the moment. So that in economics terms, in view of the theoretical economic model, should be actually giving you also this kind of safe incentive to have more holdings of cash. So you can use these. These are really simple models. You have not derived any kind of dynamic stochastic equilibrium for the consumers or household sector, firm sector, and banking sector. These are the original standard ideas that are over 80 years old, 90 years old already, but they are still holding there. So there's some kind of beauty in these models still going on. You just have to stop thinking about the current situation. What are the incentives to do something? What are the main variables that have an effect on your decisions? Income and interest rate in the Keynesian liquidity framework are the main things, but also the uncertainty related to these things that we listed there. So stability of the money demand function is in the focus of central bank. It wants to stabilize also, because even though it doesn't really, it's not able to directly affect the money demand, because that comes from the general public's preferences. It can only determine the money supply by definition, but it wants to stabilize also the money demand. So if it's unstable and undergoes substantial unpredictable shifts, as Keynes originally believed, then velocity is almost completely unpredictable. You cannot predict what is the velocity near term. And quantity of money may not be very tightly linked to aggregate spending, actually. Now it is not. We are now observing, actually. So basically, it can be the case that the velocity is really very difficult to forecast at the moment. So it's changing quite a lot. There can be many structural reasons for that. Payment systems are changing. Potential of the cryptocurrencies is now under discussion. Can they really be used as a medium of exchange? Some of you are really already investing to those. So you have an idea that probably it could be something that you also could use as a medium of exchange. For example, nowadays you can use Bitcoin to buy Amazon products. Well, let's see what happens in the near future, but it is the case at the moment. It definitely, at the aggregate level, obviously does have an effect on the velocity of the standard money demand, normal money issued by the central banks. So it is something that is changing now. Stability of the money demand function is also crucial to whether the central bank should target interest rates or the money supply. So basically, this gives you the reason why the central banks are also very interested about the overall development of money demand. Because it gives you as a central bank an idea which one of your tools would be the relevant thing to have to be affected. So now they are focusing clearly. Which one is the one that they are focusing clearly now? Is it money supply or interest rates?
Money.
Yeah, it's money supply, because the interest rates have now hit the lower bound in Federal Reserve completely. And also at the ECB, they are really, really exceptionally low, at the negative side. So they are focusing on money supply now, because the interest rate tool has been used. It's not possible to basically have huge effects on the money demand through the changes in interest rates anymore. So you have to do your things through the effects on money supply. So that is the reason why they are now working like this. So it's really important for the central banks to focus on this. But at the moment, it's not the case that the interest rate sort of a weapon would be still very heavily used, because basically you first have to somehow be able to get rid of this unconventional monetary policy liquidity in huge liquidity injections, after which you can start to figure out whether the interest rates would be the thing that would have an effect on the real economic behavior through the money demand effects. So we are living really unconventional times in many ways. But nevertheless, it's still relevant to discuss about these ideas about how monetary policy actions would be channeled to the real economy if we would be working in a bit more normal situation, because we really try to go towards back to normal times when interest rate really has this discounting role, the discount factor role in all kinds of behavior of the economic agents. So in textbook, standard textbook representations, this analysis is based on simply focusing on the aggregate demand that starts from the idea of IS curves. Probably some of you have heard about these curves. So IS refers to the equilibrium condition in the commodity markets. So in that case, the equilibrium refers to the optimal consumption of the things that are related to the commodity markets regarding consumption for households and investments of the firm sector. That is referring to the situation where investments and the savings are at the same level. So savings are the residuals after your consumption from disposable income. Savings are being channeled to real investments through the banking sector, through both the direct and indirect channels of financial intermediation for the real investment purposes of the firm sector. So that gives you an idea about the equilibrium in the commodity markets. Everyone is satisfied in the equilibrium, and every prospective or profitable real investment projects get their funding from the excess income in the form of savings that the household sector is willing to give. That's the simple idea. So we are talking about the planned expenditure, and by definition, that's the total amount of spending of domestically produced goods and services that households, businesses, government, and foreigners want to make. Everything is produced here in Finland when we calculate the planned expenditure at the Finnish level. Aggregate demand is the second thing, or the next thing that follows from these ideas of the equilibrium in the commodity markets. Aggregate demand is the total amount of output demanded in the economy. So that gives you an idea about the aggregate demand. And this is basically the animal that the politicians often want to discuss, even though they don't always completely understand that what are the relevant policy actions that have an effect on each individual item in the aggregate demand. So I will try to give you an idea about that. So the total quantity demanded of an economy's output is the sum of four types of spending. Consumption expenditures, you can use your income, disposable income to consumption, and planned investment spending by the firm sector, public purchases by the government, and net exports. So if exports is bigger than imports, then you have a positive net exports value there, and vice versa. If imports is bigger than exports, then you are in deficit in terms of a trade balance. We are talking about trade balance here. So it would be really useful to have some kind of ideas about the equations that give you an idea about the relevant variables that have an effect on, for example, consumption, investment, and net exports. So consumption expenditure and the consumption function gives you an idea about the consumption expenditures. There, the most important factor or the component is the disposable income. Disposable income refers to the income after taxes. So basically, we are here talking about aggregate taxes, not just income tax, but all other things also. And the marginal propensity to consume, MPC, is the slope of the consumption function. So we would like to, as an economist, we would like to optimize your consumption. So you would like to take the first derivative of your consumption function. Then you are discussing about the effects of one unit change in the disposable income in terms of change in your consumption. How much does your consumption change when the disposable income increases or decreases by one unit? We assume that all kinds of consumption items here are normal items. So when your income increases, you want to increase the consumption of everything. Obviously, that depends quite a lot on your relative level of income and also on wealth, but this is a simplification. Let's assume it like this. Change in consumer expenditure that results from additional dollar of disposable income is, and here the A is autonomous consumer expenditure that refers to the amount of consumer expenditure that is not dependent on the disposable income. If you inherit something, you can also use your savings for your consumption. You can get the public support from the social service system. So that's sort of those parts are captured by this A. It's something that's assumed to be giving you an idea about the facts that are not dependent on the disposable income. So you can give a really, really simple representation for your consumption function. What are the relevant things that have a role to play there? What about investments? What about the firm sector? Fixed investments are always planned. Inventory investments can be unplanned. They depend on the demand of your goods, probably. And then planned investments are the thing that really are the politically relevant things that the policymakers want to enhance by the policy actions. So planned investment spending is dependent on interest rates because the interest rate gives you an idea about the cost of real investments. Then the expectations about the future development of the economy are also relevant. So basically, this is also kind of a discounting function for the part of real investments that the firm sector is making here. Remember to make a clear distinction that we are not talking about financial investments, we are talking about real investments, because these are part of the aggregate demand definition. That's a completely different thing. Even though we have similar things there that have an effect on the financial investments, the rates of return of the assets that you are considering in relation to other assets, expectations about the future price development, expectations about the future ability of, for example, firms to pay dividend to you, and so on. So there are lots of same components actually there in financial investments, but you have to make a distinction here. You are not talking about financial investments, so you're not talking about nominal things, you're talking about real things. Build up a factory, build roads at the government or the public investment side. And that introduces you the most important components there. Then there's this net exports component. So it's made up of these two components, autonomous net exports and the part of the net exports that is affected by the changes in real interest rates. So the differences, for example, between the interest rates in home country and the foreign country are also relevant here. But to simplify, we are only considering the domestic real interest rate. What is the sensitivity of net exports with respect to the domestic real interest rate? The X refers to the sensitivity of the exports to the real interest rate. It has a negative sign in front of it. So if the real interest rate is increasing, net exports is decreasing. So the sensitivity is giving you an idea about the amount of change. How much does it react? And then these government purchases, governments have an effect on aggregate demand in two ways, through their purchases, G, and taxes. So taxes are relevant in the government part of aggregate demand components and also in the private part, because taxes have an effect on the consumption function. Remember that you have the disposable income there in the consumption function. So it has a dual role there. First of all, it has an effect on the deficit of the government budget or government financial situation, and then it has an effect also on the disposable income of the consumers. When we are talking about goods market equilibrium, it simply means that everything that is being produced in the Finnish economy is being also demanded. So consumption, expenditure, and planned investments, spending, government purchases, and net exports are being produced in Finland or in the country in question. So you can calculate these things for a certain periods of time. Usually we calculate these for quarterly observations. So every 3 months, after every 3 months, we calculate the amount of these things and they get to be recorded to the Statistics Finland reports. So basically you can calculate and you are mostly interested about these things in annual level. What is the annual production? What is the change in the annual production compared to the last year? Currently, we are experiencing high improvements or quite a strong improvements in the aggregate demand, meaning that aggregate output. And we are actually experiencing some kind of pressures in terms of the price development for some sectors because the demand is now increasing more rapidly than the supply. So there are some inflation pressures, especially, for example, in the energy sector in some countries. Not Finland so much. I was happy enough to see that my closest gas stations, there was a truck filling the tanks there so I can get my gasoline to drive back to Oulu in the afternoon. But nevertheless, there are some countries that are experiencing really, really strong difficulties in this. So there are price pressures. The first thing that reacts if the markets are not the aggregate economic or the goods markets are not in equilibrium is the price. Price of individual sectors of these consumption goods and investment goods and government purchases and so on. So let's go now and dig a bit deeper in the background of the so-called IS curve. What is the role of IS curve? It should give you an idea about the points at which the goods markets are in equilibrium, as I already mentioned there. Everything that you want to consume, you are enabled to consume, and the residuals after that from your disposable income are in the form of savings being channeled to the real investments of the firm sector. That's a really simplifying thing, but that is the idea behind the standard aggregation of the items that belong to the demand, aggregate demand and aggregate supply also. So it gives you an idea about the equilibrium where aggregate output equals aggregate demand. And it assumes originally fixed price level where nominal and real quantities are the same. This is not a thing that is holding in real terms or real world, but the original idea gives you, it's easier to start the analysis based on assuming constant price levels. So there's no inflation in this economy originally. You can figure out things that are in real terms based on the reported nominal values. You are not taking too much, you are not giving too much role for the inflation. It has been the case that it has been holding actually in most of the European countries for many years already because inflation rates have been really low. So it's actually not so violating assumption in terms of the actual behavior and theoretical ideas. IS curve is the relationship between equilibrium aggregate output and the interest rate. Why interest rate? Why is it relevant to give the relationship between amount of aggregate output as a thing that is dependent on the interest rate? We have been discussing about this already. In which parts of the aggregate demand or the IS or the commodity market, goods market, equilibrium points or equilibrium values, which are the items that are being affected by interest rate? Basically, all the other things except the public consumption or public expenditures. Through the Keynesian liquidity theoretical analysis, money demand by the households and also by the firms, but especially by the households, is partly given by the interest rate. So consumption is reacting to the interest rate. Obviously, the second thing that reacts to the changes in interest rate is the firm sector investments. So at least these two guys are really reacting. And then we remember that actually also the net exports are depending on the interest rate because they are dependent on the real interest rate. So interest rate is there also in nominal terms, playing a role. So there are actually many things that give you a background. Why can you actually give the dependence between the aggregate output and interest rate in this way? So if there is a change in the interest rate, what is the sort of a economic agent that has a power to do that?
Central bank.
Central bank will be affecting the aggregate output through that system or through that chain of events. We have been discussing a lot about that. So that gives you a reason why you can or you should analyze these things in terms of the changes in the interest rate. What are the effects on the aggregate output, aggregate demand, intuitively? So we are not giving here the general price level in the y-axis because that would be the standard thinking aggregate, because we are talking about aggregate output. So production of things refers to the supply, and we are also talking about aggregate demand. So the natural thing in terms of equilibrium analysis would be to talk about prices, obviously, prices versus quantities. But through these ideas about what are the relevant things that have an effect on the aggregate output components, then it's relevant actually to give this in terms of interest rates, because there are lots of things that are being affected by the interest rate. So here we have various regions that brown, or is it something like that? Brown area refers to the region of excess supply of goods. And when there's an excess supply of goods, obviously the equilibrium situation refers to a situation where you should have less output at the same level of interest. So basically, if the central bank is not willing to do anything to restore the economic equilibrium, then it will not be changing the interest rate. And if there is an excess supply, then basically something has to change. So the quantity changes. You get to the new equilibrium point. And when there is an excess demand for goods, we are here in the blue area, somewhere there below this line of IS equilibrium curve, the goods market or commodity markets equilibrium. So we have a situation where there's more demand than there is supply. So the supply has to adapt to that situation. So somehow we have to get to the situation where the supply is also meeting the demand. You have to increase production. That's a really simple way of thinking. And here we are assuming that the central bank is not willing to do anything for the interest rate. If it's willing to do something, then it will be reacting to this excess demand situation or excess supply situation. If you want to have the original amounts of these productions, then the central bank will be changing the interest rate. That's the thing there. You have to sort of realize that what are the central arguments in the behavior of IS curve, and who is the one that is able to have an effect on which variable. Households can decide their consumption, firms can decide their investment, public sector can decide their expenditures and income or revenue, and foreign agents can decide their behavior. So the net exports is being more or less dictated by the foreign behavior. But it also is something that the real interest rate is having an effect on. Remember also that here we are now basically drawing the figure based on the real interest rate, because that's the relevant thing in real economic actions. And it's now possible to do if we assume that there is zero inflation in the economy. So even though you get the nominal interest rate that is being focused by the central bank also, you are able to do this analysis based on the real interest rate because inflation rate is zero. That's a really harsh assumption, but it's now relevant to simplify these things. Why the economy heads towards the equilibrium? You have to just remember these things that have the biggest roles there. By far the biggest role comes from the firm sector reactions, because the only argument there in the investment function is the interest rate. That's the only argument. And actually, this is the thing that investment, real economic investments by the firm sector in the calculations of aggregate demand, they are the ones that fluctuate the most. Consumption is fairly stable. It doesn't vary so much throughout the years and throughout the quarters. But for example, in terms of reactions to general uncertainty indexes or measures, for example, in the Finnish economy, I wrote with some of my PhD students a paper about this to Kansantalouden aikakauskirja, and we analyzed the role of various uncertainty measures. How do they affect the components in the Finnish aggregate demand? And the real investment part is the one that reacts the most. It's the most volatile. And also, hence, it's really important by the central bank to try to figure out the optimal level of interest rate, because that's the only argument basically in there. In addition to these expectations and uncertainty things, the real interest rate is the thing that has an effect on investments. Then the net exports is the thing also, but there you have to obviously remember that there actually the inflation rate is really important. We are now assuming here that it's zero, but in real terms, it's really important for the net exports determination. What is the level of inflation rate in your country compared to the other countries? So are your products competitive with respect to the imports, for example? Are they competitive in the foreign countries where you want to export your? Is the price too high compared to the domestic products there? So inflation differences are really actually very important here. Here we are assuming that inflation rate is still zero. Then the IS curve gives you the points at which the total quantity of goods produced equals the total quantity of goods demanded. We are in equilibrium. And the output tends to move towards points on the curve that satisfy the goods market equilibrium. So the market forces are working there all the time. And if the central bank for some reason or other wants to get involved to this process, then the thing that it will be starting to affect is the interest rate. If it wants to stabilize the economic development, it wants to have the same level of growth or level of production, actually changes in the level of production, it will use its policy tools. It will use interest rate policy tool, or it will use money supply tool. to do these things. Okay. What are the factors that shift the IS curve? So when you are talking about changes in the interest rate and changes in the quantity, you are talking about changes in the IS curve. You are moving along the IS curve. So you are assuming that nothing else changes. How would the interest rate change if the central bank sees that there is a change in the production and it wants to have an effect on that? It is assuming that we are staying on the same IS curve. It doesn't change the location. So if it changes interest rate, it will have an effect on consumption, it will have an effect on investment, it will have an effect on the net exports. So you are still in the same IS curve. But if it shifts, something else happens. Something else than changes in production and changes in interest rate. So if it shifts, there is a change in autonomous factors that are not dependent on the interest rate. There are lots of things that have an effect on the autonomous parts of consumption, investments, and net exports, for example. So one example is changes in government purchases. And we are now here assuming that the central bank decisions are not dependent at all on the government's decisions. But this is not holding now. So this is a really a questionable thing now, but we are sort of we want to separate the governmental or fiscal policy decisions from the monetary policy decisions. So they are two separate items, even though by changing the amount of monetary base, central bank can finance basically changes also in the government purchases. But in terms of the interest rate policies, you should be actually able to separate, make a separation between these two. So government purchases is the thing that changes as an exogenous thing to the monetary policymakers. It's not the case at the moment, but originally, ideally, it should be. So if there's a shift in the purchase of government items, then there's a shift towards right. So it gives you an idea, if the central bank is not willing to react to this exogenous shock in terms of changing the interest rate, then it will be absolutely resulting to a situation due to the autonomous increase in the government spending that the total demand will increase. So IS curve will be shifting to the right and the aggregate output in equilibrium will be changing. Assuming that the central bank is not willing to do that. In real terms, if this is being seen as an unnecessary extension of public expenditures, what would be the reaction of monetary policy makers if they are not dependent on these governmental decisions? If they want to maintain the previous level of aggregate output, what would the central bankers do? Yeah, they would tighten the monetary policy by raising the interest rate. So the new interest rate, if you want to maintain the original level of aggregate output, the new interest rate would be around 6%, double the interest rate compared to the original. But nowadays, central banks are not very much willing to do this because they are heavily involved in financing the fiscal policy actions. This is really a big problem. You cannot make a distinction between monetary policy actions and fiscal policy actions at the moment. The other possibility is the changes in taxes, because that's the other part of the government sector effects in the aggregate demand. At any given real interest rate, rise in the taxes causes aggregate demand and equilibrium output to fall. So it moves the IS curve to the left because it had a negative sign there in the definition of aggregate demand. So it will be moving, or aggregate income, it will be moving to the left. If there's a cut in taxes, then vice versa, the IS curve will be moving to the right. So it will be an expansionary fiscal policy action. And these are the things that actually the Finnish parliament, for example, the Secretary of Treasury, Ministry of Finance, Annika Saarikko, is actually now giving some suggestions that perhaps it should be necessary to increase the purchasing possibilities of the private sector by lowering the tax rates. She's talking about income tax rates at the moment. We are living already an expansionary period. So it's a bit questionable thing. The government is running into more debt, more and more all the time. We are taking 7 billion euros more debt next year. Obviously, some of that is being used to pay the previous debts. So the net debt increase is not near 7 billion. But nevertheless, we are also running into more debt. And our economy is growing. Around 3% perhaps this year, and probably around the same level next year. And she's talking about cutting taxes. What's the economy reasoning for that, actually? Why would she want to do that? Is it a political? It can be completely political reason.
The next elections.
Yeah. She's heading for the next elections and she wants to be the prime minister. But we will see what happens in that case. But nevertheless, it's a bit questionable thing, just based on these ideas. Because through the other components of the aggregate demand, our economy is already increasing, and she wants to enhance the private consumption through lowering the income tax rate. Well, there are some questionable demands. Other politicians have an idea that it might not be a relevant thing to do because it's not increasing consumption so much, because the consumption is the smoothest part of the aggregate production definition or aggregate demand definition. Nevertheless, in economic terms, you can do these analyses by taking a look at the position of the IS curve. And the main thing here is, once again, that what is the central bank's role? Does it want to react to that or not? If it doesn't want to react to that based on reactions with respect to the interest rate, it allows the things to go on. So it allows the IS curve, for example, in the case of increases in taxes, to go to the left. So once again, you can discuss about the relationship between interest rate and aggregate amount, but you assume that the main things there in the determination of IS curve do not change. So for example, marginal propensity to consume does not change. That is the relevant thing in the consumption function. So the slope of the IS curve doesn't change at all. It would have an effect on the slope of the IS curve. Or sensitivity of the net exports, that X variable there, it doesn't change. It also would have an effect on the slope of the IS curve. We assume that these things don't change. And here also the central bank is not reacting. So it allows the change in the real economic activity to happen. So there are these three main important autonomous parts in the IS curve that may change. There may be change in the autonomous consumption, autonomous investment spending, and autonomous net exports. And nowadays, actually, these are the things that are reacting to these various uncertainty things. Consumer confidence has a big role there in the autonomous consumption part. In the autonomous investment spending, the firm confidence or the purchase indexes have a role there. And also there, the obviously the foreign confidence indexes have a role to play there in the net exports. So the uncertainty information is really relevant nowadays. It has a role to play in determining the autonomous levels of these various parts of aggregate demand. So if you want to analyze parametrically, for example, the sensitivity of the Finnish economy with respect to these various measures of uncertainty indicators, you could do that, for example, as a comparison for the Swedish case. Just analyze this aggregate demand, definition of the aggregate demand components. How do they react to the changes in the, let's say, for example, economic policy uncertainty, that you can get. It's a publicly available index. VIX index gives you an idea about the uncertainty of the stock markets. Are there differences in the special components in these definitions? And there clearly are. And it's an interesting thing, actually, that they are very different. For example, the investment part reaction to the uncertainties is clearly different in Finland compared to Sweden. There's some empirical findings regarding that. So let's go back now, first of all, to the part of autonomous consumption. If there's a rise in autonomous consumption, it would raise the increase the aggregate demand and equilibrium output at any given interest rate, assuming that the central bank is not doing for that, anything for that. It will shift the IS curve to the right. Decline will cause a change to the other direction. That's the main thing. And nowadays, the autonomous parts are really heavily impacted by the uncertainty things. So they are not basically related to your disposable income at all. They are exogenous shocks that have an effect on your beliefs. Are you willing to save more now, or is your precautionary motive having a bigger role in terms of money demand? You want to save more now instead of consuming. So it's really something that's of interest. And then obviously also in the investment spending for the firm sector, there are these autonomous components that are related to the uncertainty things quite a lot. It will cause similar kind of changes if the autonomous, so if the uncertainty about future development regarding the firm investment possibilities, if it decreases, it will have a positive effect on the IS curve. So it will shift to the right. Uncertainty is always a bad thing. It reduces your current investments, basically. It's not profitable to do things because you probably aren't able to sell them in the future. So you're not willing to do the investments at the moment. So for the investment, autonomous investment component also, the same holds as for the autonomous consumption in the decreasing case of autonomous investment. Then the net exports, if there's an equally in the same ways, there's a change in the increase, autonomous increase in net exports, it will lead to an increase in equilibrium. And once again, it will shift the IS curve to the right and vice versa. If there's a change in autonomous net exports that's declining, then the IS curve will shift to the left. And once again, this is also very much related to the uncertainty things. Luckily enough for empirical economists, we nowadays have various kinds of indicators for uncertainty. So you can actually model in parametric terms the effects of changes in uncertainties on these autonomous parts of the aggregate demand definition. So you can really do empirical analysis. I would very much like to see that some of you would be interested in doing these kind of macroeconomic, really purely empirical macroeconomic comparisons between the countries, for example. How are different countries, let's say in the Nordic area, how are they reacting with respect to these individual components in the aggregate demand? How are they reacting to the various indicators of uncertainty that are globally available? Is, for example, the US economic policy uncertainty more important for the Swedish investment behavior of firms compared to the Finnish firms? When you compare the effects of US economic policy uncertainty to the European case, European economic policy uncertainty? Or is it the global uncertainty that actually has the role there? You can do these analysis. It's simple time series analysis, or it can be panel econometric analysis. Take a set of countries and a longer period of observations and do a panel econometric analysis. So other factors that still shift the IS curve are related to actually these financial frictions. And these financial frictions are mostly related to the firm sector, the real investment behavior. So if there's an increase in financial frictions that has actually sort of realized, especially after the financial crisis period, global financial crisis of 2007-2009, we have now seen that the frictions in financial markets, which means that there are shocks, negative shocks in the valuation of financial assets, they seem to have an effect on the real investment behavior of firms. Can you give me an intuitive explanation why it is the case? Do the firms really do their funding of, get their funding for the real investment projects from the secondary markets that are the ones that really react to these financial shocks? Do they get the funding from there? No. So why would that have an effect on the primary sources of funding from the primary markets? When they do, for example, IPO, initial public offering, what is the connection of these things? Why the secondary markets, financial markets, are so important? Sentiment is the first thing that plays a role there, because if the sentiment is bad in the secondary markets through, based on the events that happened there in the financial crisis, they get lower amount of funding based on the IPOs. And it can even be sort of experience in the secondary market can be experience a liquidity crisis. So you cannot sell anymore anything there because no one is willing to buy at that low level of prices. So if the liquidity sort of crashes in the secondary markets, it will have an effect on the primary markets also. It's almost impossible to issue any kind of new forms of assets, IPOs, or in actually cryptocurrency markets also, initial coin offerings. It's really difficult to get any kind of those offerings to go through when the liquidity in the secondary markets, people are not willing to buy anything. You don't know the information about the issuing firm when you go and do an IPO. As a purchaser of that asset, it's really difficult. You have to get lots of information. But previous history, the announcements regarding the IPO are really important information giving at that stage. It's really very difficult to get funding. So that is the reason why the secondary markets are really important. So in general terms, it's useful to measure the degree of financial frictions. What is the liquidity in the markets? What is the general level of pricing in the markets? What are the returns? Because it will have an effect on the primary markets. The primary markets are the one where the firms get their funding for the real investments. You should understand this. We are always talking about real investments compared to the financial investments. So they are completely two different things. So in general terms, in this model, we assume that if the financial frictions increase, then it raises the real cost of borrowing to firms and hence causes investment spending and aggregate demand to fall. Real cost of borrowing increases because the default premium increases and the prices go down. When the default premium increases at IPOs, then the prices are low. So it's really difficult to get the funding to buy the factories or build the factories. So that's the chain of events that happens there. So from the point of view of central bank, actually, the idea of trying to lower the effect or the level of financial frictions is really important also. It's one of the things that they have in mind when they do also monetary policy actions. And this is actually the most important thing that they started to do, most important reason why they started to do this unconventional monetary policy actions after the global financial crisis. They wanted to keep the markets going on, especially the secondary markets. Because if they stop working, then also the primary markets stop working. So it's really impossible to get the funding for real investments. So that is really important there. So we should be discussing about the role of then role of central banks in terms of also or basically mainly in terms of the effects of interest rate on this real economic activity. So we are not just talking about Fed, we are talking about all central banks. So they want to do their monetary policy actions by steering or changing their steering rates. And in the case of Federal Reserve, the main steering rate is the Fed funds rate that we have been discussing here. And that is the main reference rate for banking activities. So banks can lend to each other based on that. So they are borrowing and lending the excess reserves from their balance sheets between each other. And the Federal Reserve is really active player there in these markets. So it will have an effect on the prices that get to be quoted, and hence the interest rate for the Fed funds assets that get to be quoted in the market. So when the Fed funds lowers the Fed funds rate, actually we should be talking about target rate here, because the final sort of outcome is based on the market behavior, but it has this idea about the target rate. So nowadays it's between 0 and 0.25. If it's approaching the market prices and interest rates are approaching the 0.5 level, then the central bank will get active in the markets to keep it below. So it will be increasing the demand to have the interest rates lower there. That's the general idea. Always remember that discounting idea. Prices and interest rates are the two sides of the same coin. Okay, so when the Fed fund raises the target Fed funds rate, real interest rates rise. So basically, this is assuming that the inflation rate is once again zero. So this is really, really the case. So they have basically this kind of monetary policy curve. In earlier textbook presentations, like for example, in Monkey textbook, we usually discussed about, some of you might have studied these things based on so-called LM curve, money market curve. But that's actually not the modern way of thinking. We are still talking about money market equilibrium because these things are working there at the background. We are talking about money supply and we are talking about money demand, but we can now actually simplify that to the demand side completely, because the relevant things can be modeled in terms of the relationship between aggregate components of demand and the interest rate. So basically, it's more sensible to do this analysis based on this monetary policy curve, because the relevant participant there is the central bank. Like I have been emphasizing here that if the central bank doesn't do anything, then the things go like this in terms of changes in the aggregate demand, if we have these autonomous changes there. So the thing that has to be taken into account are the reactions of central bank. And central banks nowadays use these kind of rules, like a Taylor rule, to do these things. But in the general level, we can talk about the so-called LM curve, which refers to the idea that the liquidity that the central bank is providing is being used to the money demand by the other sectors of the economy. So the money markets are in equilibrium also. We have there on the x-axis, we have the amount of money, and then on the y-axis, we have the interest rate once again. So if we combine these to the overall network of things, we can draw the aggregate demand and aggregate supply curves at the end of the day there. But it's more relevant nowadays to discuss this in terms of monetary policy rule or monetary policy curves. So it gives you an idea about how the monetary policy measured by the real interest rate reacts to the inflation rate. And this comes from the nowadays very standard idea of Taylor rule, because it's empirical, it's an empirical finding from the US economy around 1970s, 1980s, at the beginning of 1990s, that there is a relationship there. The real Fed funds rate reacts to the inflation deviations, and it reacts to the real production deviations. So it's a real thing that has happened. So we simplify once again that central bank has this kind of idea about the relationships between the real interest rate and inflation. So if there is a change in inflation, there is an increase in inflation with respect to the target level and inflation, then the Federal Reserve or ECB is reacting to that by changing the interest rate. So there is this target real interest rate actually that it is forcing. There's an autonomous component of that. So this is a long-term equilibrium value for the real interest rate, basically. And in Western economists, it has been around 3% actually. It's not that anymore. It sort of collapsed after global financial crisis. But before that, in very long term, the target real interest rate was around 3%. But the main idea here is to understand that this has a positive slope. If inflation pressures or inflation deviations from the target are increasing, then the central bank is doing tightening monetary policy actions. It will be increasing the real interest rate. So this parameter estimate here has a positive sign. It gives you the sensitivity of the central bank to the changes in the inflation with respect to the target value. How eager is that individual central bank to react to the change in the inflation with respect to the target value in terms of changing the interest rate? So the monetary policy curve is upward sloping. It has the same slope as the LM curve, actually. So if you have done this analysis using the LM curve previously, just replace that with this monetary policy curve, because it's based on the reaction function of the central bank. In the demand discussion, aggregate demand discussion, we assume that there are changes in the autonomous components and the central bank is not doing anything. But now we enable the possibility that the central bank is doing something. So it's reacting to these changes in the demand. So it's reacting based on the monetary policy curve. So real interest rates rise when the inflation rate rises. So it looks like this. So this should resemble the LM curve that you have been using perhaps in the bit older versions, but the modern textbooks actually use this one. Because also in the, let's say, for example, central bank aggregate models, the dynamics, stochastic general equilibrium models, they don't have this money market equilibrium there anymore. They have tailored kind of rules, monetary policy rules. So the monetary policy curve is there in the model. But the main thing for you to understand here is that it has a positive, because inflation, higher inflation from the target is a bad thing. So central bank wants to react on that by increasing the interest rate. Okay, so basically this Taylor principle is playing a role there behind these things now. So key reason for this upward sloping monetary policy curve is that central bank seeks to keep inflation stable. And this will be holding also in the conditions of climate change. In the new models that the central banks are now developing for the monetary policy actions that take into account the various effects of the climate change, still this stable inflation is going to be the main sort of a framework of the monetary policy actions. And it's based on this Taylor principle originally. So in order to stabilize inflation, central banks must raise nominal interest rates by more than any rise in expected inflation to have an effect on the real rate. If they change it exactly the same amount as the inflation, expected inflation changes, then the change in the real interest rate is zero. So if it wants to have real effects, it has to increase nominal rate more than the inflation is increasing. So R rises when pi rises. So if a central bank allows R to fall when pi rises, inflation rises, then we are at the equilibrium. So here's this chain of events that starts to play a role using our notation. When inflations increase, it has an effect on real rate of interest. It will lower, so it will have an effect on the aggregate demand. It will get higher, It will then have an effect on the inflation. It will get higher. And once again, this chain of events keeps on feeding itself unless the central bank wants to do something. If it wants to stop this process, this circle of things going on, then it will be increasing the interest rate more than the inflation is increasing. Otherwise, if it's not doing that, this chain of events will be going on and it will be keeping itself, feeding itself up until the end. So we will be experiencing really high rates of inflation in the economy. Okay, I think the time is up now. So we will continue from these discussions regarding the shifts in the monetary policy curve next week. So on Wednesday, Jari Mikko is going to be giving the first regulation lecture. I will continue in the afternoon, and then Jari Mikko will be giving the final lecture on Thursday. So you have only lectures on 2 days, but on Wednesday you have 2 lectures. Okay, thanks. Thanks for staying with me, and see you next week. Have a nice weekend. Stay safe if you go to the rally.
I would have a question related to the home assignment. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking that can we do it with the pair, or do we have to make it alone? Because in the instructions of the home assignment, there is like no information related to that. But when I looked up the starting instructions of this course, there was said that you can do these home assignments with pair.
Yeah, you can do those with the pair, but okay. You can then, you have to, I will sort of add the information regarding that. You have to be able to sort of specify your own effort in the
okay.
Yeah, if you are doing that, I can add that information to the instructions. You can do it in pairs, but you have to specify your own effort there. What's your responsibility?
Okay, yes, thank you.
Okay, thanks. Any other questions? Okay, then, so I will give you, like I already mentioned, the instructions for the second home assignment also next week, and I will give you also more exact information about doing that in pairs. Okay, thanks.